The myths and legends of the Æsir, the Viking gods, have resounded and resonated with people through the ages. But what are they? Religious fable? Pure fiction? Or do they contain ancient memories of ET contact from the deep past? Here to explore all this and more is the author of an exciting new book, Viking Superpowers, David Lovegrove. Dave, welcome to The Fifth Kind.
Thanks, Paul. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Now, I've got to pay tribute to the amazing career that has led you to this point, and I'll try to remember it all. You had a career, well, first as a surfer, then as a pastor, as a nurse, as a security guard, as a police officer. You are an amazing, accomplished artist, an ambidextrous artist.
Thank you.
But you're here today because you are a scholar of ancient Norse lore, and you're being increasingly recognized as an authority in this field. I know that Professor Armon Jacobson, who is a global authority in this field, has hailed you as the leading edge of new thought in this field, and in particular with reference to finding paleo contact in these ancient stories. So that's why I'm so interested to speak to you. So I'm going to begin by asking, how did you first discover the old Norse stories of the Æsir, the Viking gods, and what was the thing that first clued you that there might be ancient ET contact buried in those stories?
Well, it was really largely thanks to you. It was watching your videos, then buying your books, and then discovering Mauro Biglino and his great authority in the ancient Hebrew scriptures, as you have. I started to look at the Viking Eddas, essentially the sagas of the myths, telling the old stories, and I was quite shocked because of my long background in learning the Icelandic language, and I discovered that there was mistranslation, and when I translated properly, it was clearly saying that there was things going on the earth and in the sky and literally out where the stars are, where the planets are. And once I was seeing through that lens, everything fell into place, and so I got excited because I'd actually never been super interested in the gods. I thought it was a sort of interesting story. I was more into the practical everyday Viking matters, the adventures of kings and everyday warriors. But once I got into this, I became absolutely fascinated with it. And,
yeah. There's a very interesting overlap in our journeys there, because your work in Norse lore and mine in the Bible really hinge on translation and getting to the real meanings of ancient words, what the authors intended by those words. Mm. And in my work, and it's not just in my study of the Bible, but in ancestral narratives around the world, I always try and go for the rootsier meaning, the core meaning, rather than more developed meanings that may have been layered over the top, translations chosen for theological reasons. I really try to answer the question, what does the word mean? Are there any key words that have gripped your attention in that way and opened up a new story?
Yes, well, once again, going from your first clue, and I had read it in Eric von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods many years back, but the mistranslation of the word heaven, or what is translated in English as heaven, as soon as I looked for the original word of that, I realized the word was himin, or himni. Icelandic's very grammatically complicated, but it didn't mean heaven as in a spiritual place. It didn't mean another dimension. It literally, pragmatically meant the sky. And often the word that's used gets translated as heaven is another word, loft, which is aloft in English.
Above.
Yeah, above, that's it. And it always just means above the clouds, which really means a long way up there. Mm. They didn't have words for space, but they had words for way above the clouds and out where the planets are and the stars are.
G'day, and thank you for watching The Fifth Kind. If you like content like this and enjoy watching the kind of interviews and documentaries that we produce on The Fifth Kind, please can I ask you to do something to help support the channel that won't cost you anything. Always, if you enjoy one of our videos, remember to like and share on social media. But the thing that helps us more than anything is if you subscribe to the channel and turn on all notifications. Now, many of our subscribers, when they check, find out that they're actually not subscribed or they've been unsubscribed. So please make sure you are subscribed and then click that subscribed button and turn on all notifications so that you never miss when we upload new content. Thank you so much for your support of this channel, The Fifth Kind. We appreciate it more than we can say. So now, let's get back to the show. And the text that we're talking about, these are chiefly the text of Snorri Sturluson. So tell us who he was and why he was so important.
Well, he was a very powerful Icelandic chieftain in the 1200s. He was considered the most powerful man in Iceland at the time. He came from a dynasty called the Sturlungs. And Snorri, from his youth, was fascinated by the old stories and the stories of the gods and the heroes. Mm. And essentially, he was the person that saved the stories. Without him, we'd be missing probably two-thirds of what we know about the Viking gods.
And saved because medieval Christianity was sort of displacing all the old stories. Is that right?
Yes. It was, as has happened in so many other cultures, they really wanted to be the ones with the story of origins of humanity, of, you know, what happens after death and all these things. So Snorri flew in the face of the church, and one of the things that I found was that his opponents back then and also today paint him as a Christian and even mistakenly as a monk or a priest, which he never was. But they try to indicate that he wrote from just a storyteller's point of view. He told these stories just as quaint antiquities, and that's very far from the truth. The Icelanders particularly are very proud, very intelligent people. They don't back down. They are Vikings, you know.
Yes.
And they were forced to become Christian, and the story of that, it's quite a story, but essentially they were taken over by the power of the Norwegian king. He wanted to have great influence in Iceland, and he wanted to rule things, and he was a fervent Christian, but in that old way, whereas he probably didn't know the Bible very well. He just knew that this was the right religion, and if you don't believe me, I'll knock you on the head in some manner. And so Snorri risked all this to handwrite these stories, which he did gathered over a number of years, and he's connected to the royals in Norway and Sweden. The man who brought him up, John Lofsen, who was started the great academy at Oddi, centre of great learning and wealth in Iceland. He was related to the Norwegian kings, the Norwegian royal family. So Snorri spent 2 years in Scandinavia researching this, talking to the old timers, talking to the old poets and what we call skalds, and came back and wrote this down. And as I studied his work, I felt like I was probably one of the first people in a very long time to take him seriously.
Yes, yes. So many people have approached him as a teller of stories, that this is a world of fable and fiction that we're exploring, but there are other layers in Sturluson. There's other stuff going on. I'm going to come in a moment to some of the layers in the story of the Great Migration. Mm-hmm. But I want to come back to what I asked before. What did you first notice that made you think, wait a minute, this is a cultural memory, and it's a cultural memory of paleo contact.
Well, it was the other word. Well, there's a couple of words related. It was the word Æsir, which is translated as the gods in mm-hmm. English. But Snorri clearly says these people were the people of Asia, and they came from Ausaland or Ausaheim, which an Aus is a single one of this family, and they're always called, they talk often about how they're a family, big extended family, of very powerful, very wonderful people from Anatolia and Turkey. And that took me by surprise. In all my years of reading about the Vikings, I didn't realize that Snorri had said that these gods, these Æsir, came from that area. So that naturally led me to think about what we call Asgard, which most Marvel superheroes fans and watch the movie about Thor and Odin and Asgard know that word. The word literally means Ausgard, which means the fortified enclosure of the Aus, their sort of their base. And as I looked into the Edda, into Gylfaginning, which is the first book in the prose Edda, I was astounded to read that Asgard was not only on the earth, but it was up in the sky. And it says, great things and events and stories happened on the earth and up in the sky in Asgard. So we learn straight off that Asgard's this place that seems to me, from a paleo contact point of view, to be a great base on the earth and connected by maybe a star bridge. That's the type of theoretical bridge between heaven and earth, Yeah, I use the word.
I'm going to come back to that bridge. That intrigues me. So many parallels in narratives around the world. But I want to highlight that geographical point because we're talking about Asgard, which is a fortified place of residence. It's in Ausaland, which is in part of ancient Armenia. And we can place it more precisely because we know who their immediate rivals were. And they were the Vanir, which strongly hints we're looking at the Van province to one side of Ausaland and Asgard. So it's a real part of the world that he's referring to when he talks about this. And then when he gets onto the migration, this fascinates me because he talks about the migration of Odin and his extended family and the people with him. It's a migration from Ausaland into Northern Europe and Scandinavia and Iceland. And two surprising things happen in association with that migration. Firstly, Sturluson points to evidence in the real world that points to this being a real historic migration. And yet woven into the story as well is reference to Viking superpowers. Mm. So on the one hand, we've got something very grounded. It's a real historical event he's describing. And then, wait a minute, Viking superpowers? What's going on here? So tell us about those two aspects of that story.
Yes, well, most scholars accept that there was this great migration. They do consider that there's something to this. And as you pointed out to me a couple of years ago, there's many Scandinavian scholars, including Thor Heyerdahl, who believe that the old language that was brought from there was still the what we call Norrænu, the language of the north, which became Icelandic. And that was a real connection, and that people did seem to go in the migration age from south up to there. So they accept that. But in the stories, it talks about how they traveled overland, and everywhere they went, people were amazed at the glory of them, their beauty and their powers. And it doesn't specify exactly what it is that amazes them, but everywhere they go, people are just shocked by their beauty and power. And it also says that where they came from was the center of the earth of all amazing things. And when they went up into Scandinavia, they purposely took daughters for their sons from different powerful groups in France and Russia, Saxony, what's now modern Germany, Denmark, Sweden, Norway. And these peoples became the royal families and the noble families of those places. And when I was in Scandinavia last year on my research tour, I discovered through my good friend Asgeir, the guy looks like Thor, lives in Sweden, this two wonderful natural fortresses, and I discovered that the Swedish royal family who owns them state clearly in their museum that this is where the gods came. This is where the Aesir came.
Oh, wow.
And set up Asgard. They literally say, this is Asgard and this is where Valhalla was. And Valhalla's sort of a triangular shape rock. And I have a theory about this. So
how they were able to do this migration and take over lands and just hand them out suggests that at the very least they had military technology that was superior to the peoples whom they were landing upon. But also in the story there's, and it's clearly, you know, reportage trying to understand what it was they had, but hints of remote viewing, hints of precognition,
yes,
which could be sort of magical powers, but they could also be explanations of ancient technology.
Yes, well, you know, you've hit the nail on the head. That's one of the thing that confounds a lot of scholars with the Norse sagas is that they're full of paranormal abilities, and they talk about these things, remote viewing, getting visions that come true, dreams that come true, other much more powerful things where people make the earth open and swallow a horse, or, you know, things happen. They treat that in the sagas as normal, and then they'll go on to just other normal events. So Snorri himself writes that Odin and his dyr, who were like his disciples, who he trained up in these paranormal abilities, these superpowers, Odin and his wife had visions. They had the sight.
Yes.
They call it spaldom, which is the ability to spy or to, to see.
Yes.
They saw that they were going to be really successful and famous in the north before they left. So they headed off there, and Snorri says in 1200, he says, it's said truthfully that they brought these powers to the north. They originated them and they taught them. And then he says, and they are practicing them to this day. He's, you know, yes, this is supposedly Christian Snorri making up stories 200 years after the Viking Age. He's saying it is said with truthfulness that these powers are still being practiced up to this day. And by inference, he's saying it's said with truthfulness that Odin and all the Aesir were real and they really came here and they had these amazing abilities. And in his second most famous book, Heims Kringla, The History of the Norse Kings, it sort of means the round world. It literally means the globe. Heims Kringla means the globular world.
So Sturluson is actually bringing the story of these powers right into the present and into the real world. He sees it as a continuity.
Yes, in Heims Kringla, which means the globe of the world, he backs up what he writes in the Edda, what's called the Edda, the Gylfaginning and Skaldskaparmal. He backs that up with the same history, but Heims Kringla is presented as a thorough history, and it is. It's a very in-depth history right through the ages until the end of the Viking Age and even a little bit past it. But he treats these stories of these Aesir, these superpowers, just as pragmatically and truthfully as when he's talking about kings that we know about now, you know, the great Norse kings invading England and the Christian kings. He treats these ancient ones as just as valid. And he says straight out, if somebody makes up lies about this history, that's a huge insult. He says clearly, I'm not lying, you know. I wouldn't lie. Listen to me.
Yes.
You know, we don't tell lies about our ancestors. That would be shameful.
In your book, Viking Superpowers, which I thoroughly recommend, you suggest that not only are there references to advanced technology in the ancient narratives, but we can find it in art, in objects, in carvings. And you've actually brought a concrete example of that with you that relates to the story of Volund the Elf.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
This wonderful little brooch was sent to me by my friend Asgeir, I mentioned, in Sweden. And this is a representation of a story, one of the most ancient stories in the Eddas. It's actually in the Saemunda Edda, which is this one. So Snorri's Edda. These are two very old books. They're both from the 50s. But there's the Snorra Edda, we call it. It was a Snorri Sturluson wrote, retelling all the tales and adding lots of things that are not in this one. And this one was a compilation. We now tend to call it the Prose Edda. It's considered by most people to be authentic and very ancient. But Snorri retells these stories, but he also might have been connected with compiling this. They don't know, but definitely John Lofson, his mentor and foster father, had a big part to do with it, as did his father, Saemund the Elder. That's why in the old days they call it Saemund the Edda. The story of Volund the Elf is told in that Elder Edda about an elf who lived with his three brothers in the forest. They loved to hunt. What the nature of an elf is a puzzle, but I believe that it actually means something like Anunnaki. I think it means half Aesir and half human. Mm. I really do believe that, and I ran this by my professor friend, Arman Jakobson, and he said, yeah, you've got something to that, you know, that
yeah.
It could be that's what Alf means, like half.
Alf is half.
Yeah, Alf right. Mo, as they
half Aesir, half human.
Yeah.
Which, again, I mean, that's a narrative that repeats around the world.
Exactly. So he's a human, but there's something else to him. He has certain powers. And these three beautiful young women who, in my favourite translation of the Edda by a guy called Edward Petit, he actually calls them young alien creatures, these three beautiful girls.
Oh, good for him. I like him already.
Yeah, I went, oh, yeah, this feeds right into my narrative, but he calls them young alien creatures, and he says they lived with the boys for 9 years and then they left in their swan suits, which, you know, as I'll talk about, that really indicates to me a swan, a shape of a flying craft, created craft. And I believe that these girls were Valkyries, and the Valkyries, people know them as the gatherers of the slain after a battle, but the stories do paint these girls as Aesir. They seem to be straight out members of the family of the gods. And these girls, I believe, taught these guys technology. I do think that. So what happens is the girls leave on a mission. We're told they just disappear, and the boys are heartbroken. This particular elf, Volund, he stays at home. He's not going to hunt for her. He thinks she'll come back. He gets somehow, you know, anaesthetized. He wakes up. He finds himself in bonds. He's taken away by this evil king and queen. They force him to make jewelry, and he's considered the greatest smith. And they do some terrible things to him, so he can't walk, and he gets his revenge basically by building a flying machine, and he takes off and he flies over to their fortress and taunts them and says, you know, here I am, and he tells him all these terrible things he's done to their kids, and he slept with their daughter, and I believe that was consensual. They often say it wasn't, but from there's another saga involved, and I think it was consensual. But the king wasn't happy, and he's in this flying suit, and it says in the saga that the king's saying to his archers, shoot him down, and next thing, he zoom climbs up, and the king's yelling at him, saying, I wish there was an archer could hit you, but you're up there underneath the clouds.
Yes.
And this, I went to Sweden specifically to see this, the first thing I wanted to see, the original, and it has so many features, which I go into depth in my book about all this, but it has so many features of modern aircraft. It has ailerons, which are on the wings. One goes up, one goes down, the Turner craft.
Yeah.
He's wearing what looks like a pressure suit.
Yes.
But just to pull it out again, we could.
It's got something like jets on it as well.
Yes, it's got two little things underneath where the base of his bottom would be, and I believe these are jets. And when you look at them closely, this is a bit stylized. It's, you know, people are making brooches of this. But when you look at the real original one, as an artist, I look at these and they're stylized flames, definitely. They start thin, they become bulbous, they lick. There's two tongues.
Yes.
And whereas other straps on the body of the suit have a even line right through them, these just have a little mark. And artistically, that's what I would do too. If I was trying to say flame,
yes,
in metal, I'd make it bulbous, two licking tongues, and just a little kick to say this is just a change of tone.
So, David, being the leading edge in this field means that you are the person who is saying this, and we are wanting others from the academic world to begin to engage in this conversation. What happens when you talk to academics in this field and say, doesn't this look like technology? What's their explanation of these things?
Well, that's a great question, Paul, because I haven't actually had the chance to speak to somebody who knows this brooch about what they think. And when I met my friend Arman, the professor at the University of Iceland, as you said, you know, he said to me, which amazed me, he said, I think you're the cutting edge, the avant-garde in this field. And he wasn't saying I'm the greatest scholar he ever met. What he was saying was, you're so open-minded in your refreshingly retranslating the difficult Icelandic, and you're finding new things. And he wrote a wonderful book about the paranormal called The Troll Inside You, and that was a big influence on me with all this as well. So he was saying, you know, people like you, Dave, other people admire my book because you're open-minded, you're not closed, and that's why he thinks I'm the cutting edge, because I'm daring to think new things. But
he was also deeply impressed with your knowledge of the language, the fact that you could read it and speak it. That's something quite special, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's only 350,000 Icelanders, might be a little bit more than that now, but I have been pottering at the language for 50 years, but I've put a big effort in the last several years. And yes, Icelanders are always thrilled that somebody bothers to try to learn their language. And I've always been interested in reading. Many people put their time into learning Old Norse to read it, but I wanted to be able to speak it, yes, you know, reasonably.
We'll come back in a moment to some other non-textual things, some other objects. But I want to ask, before I forget to ask you, what is a world tree?
Right. Well, in the Norse stories, it's called Yggdrasil. That's Yggdrasil. And it literally means, very poetic. You know, there's a lot of poetry in the Norse sagas. Ygg is one of the names of Odin. And Drasil indicates it's his horse. So it means it's the horse that he rides up to space. So it's the great tree that reaches up above the clouds, and its branches reach out over the whole earth. It's always, you know, in that mythic way, it's shown as a great tree, and you know, there's the earth, and usually they indicate it's like a flat earth idea that these people didn't know much about the way the earth was. But funny enough, Hames Kringla literally says it's a globe, so they actually knew that. But the strangest thing about the tree is that it has three roots that seem to go above it. It doesn't make sense. It's got some roots that seem to go into the ground, but it talks about three roots that go out into the sky. And in my book, I talk about my theories about what that can be. But I, interestingly, if you've ever seen a wormhole in a science fiction movie, they really look like, you can imagine you're inside a tree root, you know, very up and down and around, zooming along to another section of space. And I think they are something like that. I think there's also this physical connection. I think it was technological, not an actual tree, but it looked like a tree. To anyone who saw it, it would have been the great wonder of the world.
Exactly. And, I mean, we have stories like this in other traditions. So we have the visual description of a whirlwind wind in the Hebrew scriptures, which sounds like a wormhole with craft coming through it. Yeah. And then we've got the language of the ladder that connects the heavens or space or a hole in the sky to the earth, that's in the Jacob's ladder story and the other reference to it as well. There's a story that the Edo and Yoruba people tell of Osanabuwa, the mighty one above the waters, and he comes down on a chain that connects the heavens to the earth. And if you picture all of those, it's clear that there's metaphor being invoked here to describe something that was seen. And when you ask what was seen, you realize there's a lot of correlation, a lot of commonality between these stories. It's there in the Babylonian story as well, of course, that repeats the idea of the Tower of Babel that reaches into the heavens. And
I believe the Babylonians repeat the Babel story, don't they?
You read the Babylonian story alongside the Hebrew story, they absolutely finesse each other, and they'll tell you that the Tower of Babel was actually a structure intended to dispatch people from here to their stations in the stars.
Wow.
So it's a wonderful passage. I can't remember which of my books I explore that in. I think it's the Eden Conspiracy and Escaping from Eden where I get into that. But I want to come back to objects, real tangible objects we can look at today. And to talk about those, we have to talk about P.V. Glob, the famous. So tell us about Peter Glob and his work and what he found.
Yes, well, he was a famous and well-liked, well-loved archaeologist in Denmark in the 60s. And he wrote a first book called The Bog People, where he really revealed to the world these incredible bodies found in the peat bogs that were preserved. I mean, there's one famous man's face. He's 2,000 years old. You still see all his whiskers and the pores of his skin, and he just looks like he's asleep. And so, you know, back in the 70s when I got my passion for Viking things going, this was a leap behind the Viking Age and a couple of 1,000 years back. But I read that book and I became interested in another book which I found called The Mound People. And in that book, it's talking about another 1,000 years before the Bog People. Mm. So we're going back into the Bronze Age to, you know, 2,000-3,000 years back. And in that, there's many wonderful things in there, but the thing that really grabbed me was this little triangular sort of stone called a Truho farm stone. Mm-hmm. And back in the 70s when I first saw it, I thought, now this is really strange and interesting. And on the stone it shows a ship, a famous representation of a ship, and you see these ships carved all over Sweden, a little bit in Norway. Everyone knows their ships. And in the sky above it is another ship, but it's something odd about it. It seems to curve the other way. It has the little kicked prows that all the ships always have. but it has these divots, which I read as stars. And on the side of the rock, there's a funny little man who looks like a dwarf. And he's striding along. And then on the verso side to the ships is a picture of a three-toed foot. And then beside that is obviously a human foot, a great big splore-footed, somebody like me when I was young and never ever wore shoes.
Yes.
Five toes, obviously human. There's this funny little three-toed foot, and my mind always went straight to, must be this little guy's foot, you know, because somebody's bothered to do this. He's saying, I met a strange character, and yes, they had three toes, and then beside it is this somewhat amorphous blob, and it's only really amorphous because archaeologists, it's a tradition in Scandinavia, they either use white or red paint to delineate the carving so you can see it more clearly. Once again, as an artist, I've got a really good eye for subtleties, and as soon as I looked at it, I thought, that's a boot print.
Mm.
There's a heel, and there's a straight inner edge of the inside, yeah, of the foot, and there's where it kicks out to those toes and comes back. And then beside that is, once again, these divots, what they call cup marks. To me, they're obviously stars, and I contacted Paul. I said, do you recognize this? He said, oh, I'm not sure. I'll have a look into it. He suggested a few things. And then I discovered that the Pleiades constellation is big in the Bronze Age in Northern Europe. And then we found that, you know, many cultures in our Australian Aboriginal cultures have stories about that.
Mm.
And when I looked at that, I said, yes, that's it. It's obvious that that's what it is. So this little stone is in a museum, sort of forgotten.
Yes. So on this stone from Truhoe Farm, we have stars, a boot print, a regular human footprint, and a small footprint with three toes. And we've got the depiction of a small person who's sort of dwarf size. And when I hear that, it reminds me of another story, which is, I'll try and say it correctly, the story of King Svedgur.
Yes.
And the small person
that
he met, so an anomalously small person. Can you just quickly tell us that story? It's a story I love.
Sure. Well, it's going to be in my next book. This story is going to be one of the big focuses. But a later king, more in what the scholars think of the historical period, he was fascinated with Odin. And he sort of said to his people, I'm going to go and find Odin, because Odin was his great-great-grandfather. So he went down to old Asgard. You know, he made the trip all the way down to Anatolia and around where ancient Troy was, couldn't find him there, went up into what's called Mikla Svithjor, which is Svithjof means Sweden, but Mikla Svithjof means Great Sweden, and it seems to indicate the whole north, all the mysterious, you know, polar region. And he wasn't up there, but it says he met lots of relatives up there. It's just a strange one. He's met, I think, Aesir up there. And then he comes home and he's told, you've got to go and look in God's home, Guth's hand, which means the God's world. So he gets a clue, and in the stories it says that he went to a farm where there was a great big rock called the stone, and Snorri gets it wrong here where I think he does. He sort of places it in a different area of Sweden, more in the east. But when I went to Scandinavia, I discovered in that museum, the Swedish Royal Family run, they have that story there, but they say, that's here. That's up the top of this, it's called Hulleberg. There's Hunneberg and Hulleberg. And actually, it's at the top of Hunneberg, which is also called Asgard. That rock's actually there, and I'm going there again. The next time I go to Scandinavia, I'll be making a beeline for there. But what happens is the king gets really drunk with his friends at this the stone farm, and they come out, they're heading off to bed, they're wobbly, got the wobbly boot on, and they see a light, a door's opened in the stone, and there's this little man, and he's saying, "You want to meet Odin? Come, come," you know. So Svagdir spent a lot of time, a lot of years trying to find Odin, so he's excited. He bolts, and his men are not quite as fast as him. So he goes in there, door closes, no more elf, no more Svagdir. The king goes to see Odin.
Mm, and is never seen again.
No. And this is a bit of a spoiler, but there's massive caves under Asgard, and that's something, you know, I'm exploring. My friend's over there in Sweden. He's been doing some exploring of those caves, and we've discovered a few pretty amazing things. And, we'll see what comes of that.
Ooh, wonderful. While you're with us, I must ask you to read some Old Norse to us. If you can find in this pile of books a passage you'd like to share with us and tell
Absolutely.
Us why it's special.
Well, a little passage I'd like to read is actually centered exactly where we've just been talking about, where the stone was, where the elf took King Svagdir away, Asgard and Valhalla, and they're beside a great lake called Lake Vanir, and it literally means the Lake of the Vanir.
And it sounds familiar.
Yeah, well, Vanir, it means the beautiful, like, and it's referring to Freya, who turns up in this little passage. But she's the beautiful goddess, and she came from, she was part of the Vanir tribe that was battling against the Aesir down in, you know, back home in Anatolia, in old Asgard.
Yes.
And I'm convinced that Paul's right, you know, that you're absolutely right, that it is the people of Van, this ancient culture, and we've cracked something that's been forgotten, long forgotten.
Mm.
So I'll read this little passage. It's just from Gylfaginning, which means the tricking of Gylfi. So Gylfi's this young king. It says, Gylfi konungur reith thar londum, nu heitir svithjóð, frá honum that sagt, at han gaf etni farandi kona, at lonum skemtunar sinnar, et plogsland i riki sinne. That fjör ox dragi upp dag og nott. You following this?
Oh, closely.
Hon neft gefjun. Hon tok fjör oxen norðan ur Jotunheimum, en that varu sinjir Jotuns nokkurs og hennar, og setti þá fyrir plog. En plorin gekk svá breitt og djupt at upp leisti landet. So what this says is that Gylfi the king reigned over the land that is now called Sweden. About him it is said that he met one vagrant woman, or a travelling woman, a woman living rough. And for the great pleasures that she gave him, he awarded her a ploughland in his kingdom. He basically gave her enough land. He said to her, "You can have all the land that four oxen can plough in a day and a night." So little manas to him. This lady, Gefjun, that's a name for Freya, right? The Vanir lady, powerful Aesir lady. So she goes, and in the saga it says that she goes and gets these four oxen that she's had with a giant and brings this ginormous oxen back, and they plough so they plough so deep and broad in the land that they take this huge mass of land out of Sweden and they put it in the sound where Denmark is, and that's the founding of Sealand, which is where Copenhagen is. Right, so she's basically making a home base for the Aesir. We learn later she's been sent by Odin to do this, and it's called a land grab. That's the Norse word. And she's essentially just so mind-blowingly beautiful and powerful that Gylfi just goes, "Who the heck are you?" And she says, "I'm one of the family of the Aesir, and we're coming here." And he says, "I've got to find out as much as I can about you, you know, who your people are." So he heads off on his great journey down to old Asgard in Turkey, and all sorts of things happen to him, and that's where we find out so much about the gods. Is he gets abducted and taken up into, I believe, to Asgard in the sky, and they tell him a great plethora of tales. And the incredible thing is that, and I didn't know this when I was on this journey of discovery, I got to the end of this story and I read this thing, and it said, and after they'd told him all these stories, they put him back to go and tell the stories to his own people. So it says that he, 1 minute he's talking to them, and next minute he can hear roaring all around, and he looks out to the right, and then he's on this plain, and there's no city, there's no gods, there's no Aesir. And I believe it was a re-entry capsule, and he's in,
yes,
you know, he's sort of blacked out, and he's come to, he can hear the roaring of the plasma as he's re-entering. He looks, yes, looks out the window. So he heads all the way back up to Sweden, and he tells everybody, and that was the point. They took him so he could tell these stories. But then it says, and then the people were there, the Aesir, got together and decided who each of them would be from the stories they told. So they got the crew, and the main commander said, "Well, I'm obviously going to be Odin, and, you know, the beautiful lady, you'll be Freya." And I say in the book, you know, maybe she came in by Aesir Zoom, because I think she's still back up there in Sweden and Denmark doing what she's doing. But all the other gods are there, and they take these names. And then what I think happened was they then could leave Asgard, old Asgard in Armenia, Anatolia, and head off. And people were already sort of G'd up. They'd been told the story. So when they turned up, so, "Hi, I'm Thor, you know, my name's Freya, my name's Forseti, my name's Baldur." They were ready for these people to come. And so when they saw the wonders, it was like, oh, wow, yeah, they are wonderful.
I love the detail in the wonders. I love those moments where the sound of something is described, or the feeling is described, or the feeling in the reaction to what is happening. And you just shared an example of that, the re-entry experience. And it's there in Ezekiel as well, where we've got textures described, the feeling of G-force, the sound of engines, all these things that we in the 21st century pick up on when we read these ancient stories. And you are the one who's doing this right now. I love your work. I love what you've done with your book, Viking Superpowers. And I hope we've whetted people's appetite for it. You can go to the YouTube channel, Viking Superpowers, and you'll hear more that will encourage you to get hold of the book. So people need to read that. And where's your work going next?
Well, my next book is well underway. It's called Viking Superpowers, Way of Midgard. So the first book's The Way of Asgard, The Way of the Aus, the Aesir, these godlike people. And I set the scene for that time and that world. In The Way of Midgard, I'll be talking a lot more about the human interaction with them, how they affected our lives, how they taught us these superpowers, what these superpowers are, all sorts of instances of how these powers are recorded. I'll be looking more deeply into the carvings in Sweden, particularly Bohuslän, flying ships, the Sun Cross ships,
Yes.
This incredible testimony, like the little stone I talked about, the Trehaugh farm stone, but there's like great cliffs covered in stories that, as Paul just said, and as I say in my book, it's only us moderns who are in this incredible age now where we've actually got artificial intelligence, we've actually got, you know,
flight technology.
Yeah, flight technology, similar to what's being spoken about there in our science fiction. We've got concepts. It's easy for us to now believe in going light speed and
wormholes
and all these things. They're not strange to us, but wasn't that long ago that people couldn't get their heads around that. So yes. That's what I'll delve into.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that Bahuslan section because of the flying discs, the people from the discs. These stories parallel around the world as well. We're going to have another conversation because there's so much more we need to talk about, but we'll pause there for today. And I want to say what a pleasure it's been talking to you today. And please come back again soon so we can continue.
I absolutely will, Paul. He is a hero of mine. I look up to him greatly because he's just a really nice bloke, but so smart and so groundbreaking. And your approach inspires me and has helped me a lot. You know, all your work's helped me hugely to know how to go about this, to know how to see things in a different way.
Well, the feeling is mutual. So
thanks, mate.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
If you enjoy exploring the kind of topics that we explore on The Fifth Kind, on the Paul Wallace Channel, and in my Eden series, then Ancient Knowledge Academy is the learning community for you. A learning community for people who are exploring questions of human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. We've been told ancient texts about the gods are just myths. Close encounters and anomalous experiences are just fantasy. And ancient wisdom is just irrelevant. But what if the knowledge of our ancestors is not just a reservoir of information about the past, but a roadmap to a better and bigger human experience? Ancient Knowledge Academy is an opportunity for more intentional community, more immersive learning, and a chance to connect with researchers and truth seekers from all around the world. And I will keep our feet on the ground as we explore these stretching topics. And with every subject that we bring to the courses and modules at the Academy, I will always take us to ancestral wisdom and ancient knowledge, believing that what we have in indigenous story and ancestral narratives are resources not just to understand the past, but to understand ourselves in a truer light and equip ourselves for life in the 21st century. Courses at the Academy will include all new material, audio, video, and written resources, and live face-to-face elements so that we can make this learning journey together and in real time. And the Academy enables me to connect more closely with more people who are motivated to make a paradigm-shifting journey and transform their lives. Are you ready? Unlock transformative courses, experience live mentoring sessions, and connect with our global community of seekers. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today.